I don't think anybody told you when you signed up for this conference that it was going to be an exercise in survivorship. And probably they didn't warn you that they were saving up the world's worst timekeeper for the last slot. If you feel like sleeping, I won't mind at all. The paper will presumably be eventually published, and you can read it in due course, but there will be moments of light entertainment and moments of extremely tedious verbalizing. I will give you a clue so that you can choose to sleep through those as you feel. Now, my name is Griselda Pollock. I'm chosen to introduce myself, partly in the spirit, because I used to love the way Judith would always introduce people. I just loved going to events because that beautiful, melodious voice would say hello and welcome and make sure you felt that you knew where the toilets were, where the lunch was going to be, and all the things that mattered to make you feel welcome. Well, that has been in the marvelous hands of Joy Siemens, and I think I would just like, before I start, to ask everybody to thank Joyce for an extraordinarily fine organization. I really do thank you. So, on we go. Museums can be extremely dangerous places for some of us. I think that's why Judith Mastai took them very seriously. Was a series of cartoons made by the very distinguished feminist British cartoonist Jackie Fleming in 1978 in response to the very first lecture course I gave at the University of Leeds about the problems of our relationship to what we see in the visual tract around us. I think that's a little gift to Nanette. It's also, in a sense, a question for Irit Rogoff about dressing for an exhibition. I feel it very wrong to be so light-hearted after we've been through such a remarkable panel this afternoon, which ended on a note of justified outrage or even just perhaps deep sadness and bitterness. And maybe that's closer to where I feel in a way, because I did not know how to do this lecture at all, for this is no ordinary conference paper. In fact, I very much thought until the last minute I would arrive with no paper at all. The mere thought of being in this very position to speak of Judith rather than to Judith plunged me back into those dark places many of us know from last year when the desperate news of her illness spread amongst people, complacently imagining the permanence of Judith's powerful and eccentric place in a strange and often exhilarating adventure of thinking about art and life. The paper that I have written is clearly an intellectual's defense, and it came about when at last I let go and tried to understand for myself how it all made sense. What was Judith up to? What do I understand now in this bereaved retrospect of what I participated in? She alone understood the master plan in which I was a companion, but mostly a well-directed performer. I wanted to do so much, much tonight. I wanted to talk about so many things. I could have talked about Judith's remarkable work on women artists, her fascinating rereading specifically of the work of Emily Carr as Mystic Hysteric. I might want you to go back to our discussions, the love letters I wrote over Mary Cassatt, introducing the question also of looking away. I wanted to think about her reanimation of the debate about women and painting. I perhaps wanted to think about the relationship that I never took up in a discussion over Charlotta Salomon, the one event she ran to which I was not able to come. But it leads on to a desire to have discussed with her my interest in the question of trauma and representation and the long shadow of the Holocaust, which forms a central part of my work now on the Israeli artist Rachel Lichtenberg-Ettinger. I might have discussed with Judith once again her extraordinary work in bringing back into contemporary discourse the remarkable film Night Cleaners, made jointly by the Berwick Street Film Collective, and which included Mary Kelly, and her whole re-examination of the issue of the Brechtian, or the misunderstanding of Brechtianism, in the 1970s. I might also have taken her into her areas of to do with the question of the virtual feminist museum, or the museum in hyperspace in which she was so interested, touched on briefly in my opening remarks. And finally, perhaps she would have been a wonderful interlocutor with my recent work on Freud and the archaeological metaphor. Freud, one of the great collectors of the late 19th and early 20th century, shown here in this photograph with the manuscript for Moses and Monotheism, of which Christine Conley earlier spoke, gazed down upon this great atheist Jewish thinker, the founder of the modern science of psychoanalysis, who made his great discoveries and wrote his texts with the watchful gaze of Egyptian, Chinese, Indian, and Israeli or Jewish art gazing permanently upon him from their spaces of other philosophies and other religions and other traditions of intellectual investigation. These I could have done, but these I have not done. I also imagined a poetic text weaving all these threads together, but it is all too soon, the pain too raw, the question still too tough to spread the reassuring blanket of staged emotion that might collapse too easily into either my excessive affectivity or, appearing out of context, become simply sentimental self-serving. The paper is then what it became because Judith was a thinker of considerable importance. Judith was not, I think, extremely interested in art, but she was fascinated and respected deeply artists, a distinction, I think, of great importance. Judith was a thinker of considerable importance, understanding that inspires me in a dark world. After what? Well, we come after all belief in progress has been challenged. As I heard on the radio the other day, what do we do now that the hope of socialism has been seemingly so brilliantly defeated worldwide? In the present, not brilliantly, but in my sense brilliantly, but seems to be spectacularly defeated. In the present, I think we have tougher choices. Judith made them and acted on them, making little and real differences to actual people. She did not work with statistics or generalities or categories, but one by one she reached out and changed particular people's lives that really matter. So I wanted to think through why and what role art had played in this, her larger scheme. As I said, Judith didn't care much for art, but she had a profound respect for and enjoyment of the company of artists. They too were the beneficiaries of her remarkable attention. She respected them, above all, as thinkers, and we would do well to engage with that. They might have something important to say to us. So here goes, Beyond the Museum, Weaving Threads. In her book, Frames Within Frames, The Museum as Cultural Artifact, a writer called Suzanne Oberhart reminds us that for those within its walls, the museum is the invisible frame for the art it has framed. If, however, we pull back our focus, we notice yet other frames within which the museum itself figures in other discourses and representations. And one of these is popular culture, cinema to be precise, which uses the medium, or the museum, as a signifier for several widely dispersed ideas and ideals that reflect a different place for the museum in popular imagination beyond its own art world self-perceptions. I want to use one film as a way into this final talk of our conference, which aims to situate what I shall propose was Judith Mastai's singular and significant practice at this intersection of publics and meaning. My choice is Alan Rudolph's film from 1981, The Moderns, and I'll give you a quick synopsis and then show you 4 minutes. Nick Hart, played by Keith Carradine, is an American artist in Paris in the 20s. The son of a famous forger, he has inherited his father's unique artistic gift, but only scrapes a living drawing cartoons of the expatriate Americans in Paris for his friend Loiseau, Mr. Fagelman, renamed Loiseau, who writes a weekly column for the New York Herald Tribune. Surrounded by the glamorous Americans Josephine Baker and a very morose and still always drunken Ernest Hemingway, hanging out with Gertrude and Alice, he is finally persuaded by an abandoned woman of great wealth, Natalie Deville, played by Geraldine Chaplin, to copy her husband's prized paintings by Matisse, Modigliani and Cézanne so that she can sneak off to America with the originals, leaving the well-forged copies in her husband's possession. To Paris comes a self-made man called Mr. Stone. He is in rubber, i.e. he's a manufacturer of rubbers. And he wants to buy himself a large collection of art as a calculated form of economic investment and cultural advancement. Stone is now married to Rachel, Linda Fiorentino, who it transpires is actually married to Hart, whom she suddenly and inexplicably left some years before he came to Paris after a torrid romance that has left him obsessed and embittered. Deceived by Hart and unsuspecting of the switch, the said Natalie Deville secretly breaks into his studio and steals back what she thinks are the original paintings. In fact, she is mistaken, and Hart's dealer sells the originals to Stone. Stone has a party to celebrate. Natalie comes, sees the paintings on the wall, publicly denounces them as forgeries. Stone, wishing to show how little he cares for art itself, burns what he thinks are now the worthless and genuine canvases to gasp from audiences that contain art historians. And with the denouement of the rivalry between Stone and Hart over Rachel, who promptly disappears, Loiseau fakes his own death, dresses as a woman, and escapes with Hart from Paris to go to Hollywood, where the pictures move. The old world of Parisian modernism is to yield to the new world of Hollywood movies. And en route, the two men stop off in New York in October 1929. Those of you who know the history of art will know this was an important date. It was the Wall Street crash, but it also saw the opening of the Museum of Modern Art at 53rd Street in New York. Could you play the tape, please? Volume up, please, quite a lot higher. Does the volume go up at all?
We're just going to be a few minutes. Sir, I'll be here. The train to Hollywood leaves in an hour.
We'll make the train. I just want to see what they have. It's going to rain.
You know, you're so morose, it's monotonous. Babe Ruth hit 3 home runs today. And we're going to Hollywood, where the sky's always blue, the sun always shines, and we're going to be rich.
This, of course, is Modigliani, his short but fruitful life. His work is evidenced by the plasticity he employed in his nudes and portraiture as well. Always the oval face, the elongated trunk, arms. Ah, yes, Henri Matisse, Odalisque. Study, if you will, the face. It's the most realized of all of his work. In my mind, best.
Oh, no! Look at this. Can you imagine this? Boy, Natalie certainly gets around.
Aren't you Irving Fagelman? I'm Ada Kowalko. We grew up together on Flatbush Avenue.
Je ne connais pas l'anglais.
Just like Irving.
Let's proceed to Paul Cézanne. Considered to be the father of modern art, this is a work of rare emotional delicacy. This revelation cannot be taught, or can it be duplicated? Only the greatest artist can achieve what has happened here, and only then, in that rare moment in time. So let's silently observe this.
Come on, I'm bored with these pictures. I want to go where the pictures move. Besides, I like your stuff better anyway.
Just a minute. This might help me appreciate my work.
Well, gentlemen, did it touch you? Did you sense the mystery? Do you know now why this is a masterpiece? Why we praise it? Why we genuflect before it? Why it will live through the ages for all humanity? My God, I hope you understand.
Why is it you are never where you're supposed to be?
I don't know.
Have lived in Paris, lucky enough to have been young. It didn't matter who you were, because it was always worth it, and it was good.
Film dramatizes several issues relevant to our discussions that from the place that must be called after modernism, a phrase that critically distinguishes itself from the delusional aspects of postmodernism. For what would come to be known as modernism was the product of its demise, in part as a result of its musealization in a particular and contestable narrative of modern art. Modernism was always trapped in the contradiction that at its moment of its recognition as the modern, it had ceased by definition to be anything of the sort. For the museum, by definition, produces an image only of history. It historicizes, always rendering what it houses as retrospective. For its contemporary mourners now, modernism can only be the object of a profoundly archaeological impulse in which the critical rereading of what at any point was institutionalized as modernism becomes the site of a critical release from some of the aporias of the postmodern present. The film closes its narrative of thwarted and refound love with the institution of the Museum of Modern Art, with the creation of a formal logic for what was otherwise, what otherwise appeared to be the contingency of relations of production and distribution, identities in play, and interests at work. The problem is that this one logic that we identify with the Museum of Art became so utterly compelling that it remains the template for all museum engagements with the modern. Now, I'm sorry if I get this right. Nope, okay, let's go back. Yet Alfred H. Barr, no, wait a second. No. I'm just joining a long line of completely discoordinated art historians that we've displayed today. Anyway. Okay. Yet Alfred H. Barr, whom we've seen here contemplating an object in his museum, clearly planned his museum not as just a mausoleum, but an active player in the culture which it was created to curate. In the absence of existing frames of knowledge and narratives for the understanding of what appeared to be the chaotic and indecipherable rejection of the very concepts of culture the other grand survey of museums of the 19th century existed to enshrine, Barr's concept for the Museum of Modern Art was innovative and trend-setting in 1929. One of its significant interventions was to place education, or shall we say the creation of constituencies and communities for art, onto a primary agenda. Okay, so he founded a film library, he founded a photography library, he founded an architecture section, he founded a design section, he founded a library of the Museum of Modern Art, and also one of circulating exhibitions. This seemed to be an extremely important intervention at that point, for there was no widespread acceptance or means of finding intelligible what the three ruling class women founders called the art, outrageous art we all loved. Yet this museum has become the paradigm for most modern art museums, and its exhibitionary and discursive framing of the history of modern art has become the canonical model for the teaching of the subject throughout most art history institutions. MoMA created the terms of intelligibility and dissemination of the new while having to consolidate art as already known within its own fixing definitions, preferred narratives, and ultimately selective canon that installed a racist, sexist, Eurocentric conception of the modern against which we now are obliged to agitate from what have been historically created by those institutions as its disqualified margins, categorically outside what it defined alone as worthy of the art museum. The scene in the museum and the film sets up the eastern seaboard connoisseur, the educated elite, who is taking young initiatives around the new cathedrals of the modern, the art museum, where they are to stand in hushed silence to contemplate the genius of the masterpieces of modernism. Hart stands at the back, contemplating something else created for us by the narrative that we have witnessed by the film. We see the label Natalie Deville Collection. We know the history of the works. We know they are looking at paintings by Hart. Does this make a fool of the connoisseur, unable to tell the forged from the authentic? Or does it rather question the authentic itself, suggesting instead, in a sense suggested by Mika Ball, that meaning and effect of art in this musealized form is the product of its framing, institutional, discursive, and phantasmatic? We see what we desire to find because we have been taught to look for it. Therefore, what we see is what the institution desires. Sometimes we accept the staggered relations of viewing that the film stages, the desiring art lover in the first range who speaks movingly of what these paintings do for him, the aestheticization of both art object and art subject. Students stand to be transformed from ignorance and insensitivity initiated into art loving, the blank pages onto which the museum education writes its script. Hart the artist, however, stands behind these two lines of viewing, learning himself through the talk of these mediating others, finding in their misrecognition an indirect representation of himself. He says ironically, "I may learn to appreciate my work." The film affirms both sexuality and desire in its more driven abstractions as the condition of the authentic that transcends the museal classification, which is always based on two legalities, origin and ownership. And this reveals a tension in a banal and otherwise not very significant film between what we might call cultural value that derives from the site of making, with its imperatives, purposes, and singularities, however trivialized here as the theme of love, and what we can call the economic value conferred on the object that becomes, through a variety of discursive and institutional frameworks, a repository of invested value that can only be expressed in monetary terms and consumed in religious ones. It seems to me that this confusion lies at the heart of our deliberations. The preservation and educational missions of the museum and the gallery are hooked on the impossible contradiction of these twin forces, which are also twin possibilities within the modern capitalist systems in which the museum operates. Can you focus that a bit better? Thank you. No art, no life, says the legend on this flyer for new books from the major art publisher, Thames and Hudson, under a photograph by Nick Turpin of a somewhat curious viewer behavior in London's National Gallery. Seated, a white middle-aged man dressed more for a walk in the country takes his bird-watching binoculars out to an unseen painting, while other visitors perform the viewing rituals at more standard proximity to the objects on display, arranging themselves around the edges of the room and moving to the choreography of the one-by-one hanging sequence that prevails in national museums and art galleries, still working on the classic 19th century model adopted from the aristocratic palace with its series of rooms en filade in a sequence that you walk through. Seeking to get optically close to the work from which he is physically distant, the seated gallery visitor enhances his vision. The apparatus for telescoping vision across the real gap of space between viewer and painting obscures his eyes and brings the now virtualized image close, yet secretively so, allowing the man almost to incorporate it in cinematic close-up, hence privately. Enhanced vision, suspended corporality, the experience of losing oneself in the scopophilic fantasy of the magnified visual field are the hallmarks of the cinematic. In a way, this viewer perfectly allegorizes the generic art book that... That is, it is there to promote as a means both to know art, all art, art itself, art in general, art as a generality, art as a knowable generality, and in knowing art to know life, which is somehow offered also in its entirety and generality by knowing something general called art. Knowing, seeing, visually mastering leaves him centered and disembodied in a perfect fantasy that the museum as book feeds. Synonymous, book and museum, there is a short circuit to knowledge by means of the teletechnology of vision that can traverse all space and bring the distant close via representation. The art book is the purchasable commodity form of the museum. We take them home every day. Yet the art book is the museum without walls. What was once located in space and distantly so that we needed to travel here and there to see it in person, in body, can now come into my home and into my library, and I can know it, but only through the technological translation from thing to image, from encounter and event to object, from object to sight, and from its singularity in time and space to a generic example of a category whose meaning and purpose is predetermined by the infinite relations within which it is set, relations which reduce its living particularity as the product of concrete mental and manual labor within specific social relations of production, to what Marx would call, when speaking of the bourgeois subject, its unreal universality. Here, the performance of commodity fetishism becomes visible, magicking out of sight the very existence of the work, and hence the working subject that produces what the museum and the book return to us only as the image of art, art turned into an image. Now, it's a truism that the creation of technologies of photographic reproduction transformed not only our relations to art, but in effect created art, as that unreal universality producing in André Malraux's famous but incorrectly translated phrase, an imaginary museum. It's usually translated as the museum without walls, and I'm retranslating it as an imaginary museum, le musée imaginaire. Coined first in 1935 and used in his work until 1951, and published in the three-volume Psychology of Art between 47 and 50 under the title Les Voix du Silence, the Voices of Silence. As Rosalind Krauss, André Malraux with his photographs. Rosalind Krauss has pointed out in her article on the postmodern museum without walls, this term is treacherous in such a translation. Malraux's master conceit, Le Musée Imaginaire, addresses, I quote, the space of human faculties, imagination, cognition, judgment. The typical English translation, Museum Without Walls, still suggests a building even without definition and confinement, whereas Malraux was trying to suggest that the art has got inside our heads. For Malraux, the museum of the imagination or of the mind is the modern historical situation of art as such. That is both the product of stage one, the creation of the public museum, and stage two, its expansion through photographic reproduction, which by manipulations of scale, angle, uniformity of surface, creates new objects entirely for approximate lens-based visual appropriation of art. In effect, viewing becomes consumption and voyeurism at the same time. Hence, the dissemination of our generic knowledge of things as, quote, art, is structurally dependent on modern musealization itself. This effect, however, is no longer bound to architecture and place. Art makes that place which still offers us specific, if over-visualized, encounters become merely the already known guardian of the original of the image that must in many ways always disappoint because of the heightened expectations raised by the qualities of modern reproduction and of its exclusive visuality. This paradox is what offers particular possibilities for current interventions via museum programming in the museum as now what seems a redundant, even archaic, but suddenly more interesting sight of concrete, embodied, social, and intellectually directed encounter, either through the exhibition or a different access to the collection itself through acts of intervention, rereading, and disruption. Writing of even 19th century critics like Gautier and Baudelaire, Malraux reminds us of how novel the situation we inherit is. What had they seen, he says? What, until 1900, had been seen by all those writers whose views on art still impress us as important, whom we take to be speaking of the same works we know, referring to the same data as those available to us? Baudelaire and Gautier had visited 2-3 galleries, seen a few reproductions, bad photographs, prints, maybe some copies, only of a handful of masterpieces, and their readers even less. End quote. Malraux argues that the museum is the very sign of modernity's reclassification or definitive reclassification of objects from ritual, religious, architectural, and decorative uses. He argues that museums created art by extracting crucifixes from churches and making them into sculpture or painting, and portraits from dynastic galleries of aristocratic or royal power, and presenting them to us only as Titians or Rembrandts or Velasquez. This radical decontextualization and translation was in fact a widespread complaint made most poignantly by the 19th century art administrator Quatremer de Quincy, talking of museums as warehouses of cultural debris. The once revolutionary minister of culture from 1816 to 1839 in France expressed what has now become a standard complaint against the museum for having wrenched art from its vital source in social and religious life to assemble only its material hull. I quote, "It is doubtful that you transferred the network of ideas and relations that made the works alive with interest. Their essential merit depended on the beliefs that created them, on the ideas to which they were tied, the circumstances that explained the community of thoughts that gave them their unity." Bravo, we probably say. Thus, the selected great works gathered in the museum of the viewer's mind become art, or shall we say they are reduced from the vibrant cultural action that generated the work and created its meaning in a community of users, when the museum, that legacy of covetousness and national piracy, first created the level and public playing field on which once diverse objects and artifacts, relics and monuments, fragments and traces, could become comparable. So, under what rubric is material, symbolic, ideological, temporal difference of all these jumbled objects annulled and a new logic of relevant relative difference established. Style, period, nation, school, master. The answer is in the public collection, in the assemblage and display, the isolation, and in effect the aestheticization of things originally made within an aesthetico-symbolic practice that is transformed now into the Western concept of art. Now, to say this at this stage is not to judge this historical change in a banal postmodern manichaeism which says something is good or something is bad. That's just history. That's what we have to deal with. This has happened. This is the playing field. This is what we are after. This is therefore what we are determined by. So the question is what to do with what cannot be undone through nostalgia or reinvented ethnography. Now, if Quatre Mères de Quincy bewailed the isolation of objects in the museum out of their original cultural context, there were other 19th century analysts who would invert that nostalgic complaint that museums petrify and fossilize. In his reading of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, published in 1807, 1 year after Quatre Mères de Quincy's Considérations Morales, or Moral Considerations, Didier Malherbe points out, Hegel initially agrees with Quatre Mères de Quincy that art has been arraché, has been isolated and wrenched from its context. But then he performs a volte-face. And this leaves us with the alibi of the modern museum, which is, when enacted as an institution, becomes the foundation for what we learn as art history. Hegel dismisses the living garments of time and history of the artwork as ultimately incidental happenstance. Hegel endorses the fact that the museum offers us art. He uses the image of plucked fruit that is linked both to the tree where it grew and to the person to whom it is now offered. The museum mediates between the necessary conditions of art's making and its rebirth in consciousness and reflection. That's thought. What was once a mere fact, the relation of Michelangelo's David to the Signoria, becomes known and realized, becomes inward, and that knowledge reveals that what was the art's context was always a product of the mind. That's to say, always an intellectual and theoretical condition. Thus, Malherbe concludes, and I quote, "Only in cultural recollection does the true significance of culture emerge for Hegel. In that sense, our recollection of antiquity is truer to the spirit of antiquity than antiquity was in itself." End quote. Now, lest this seem merely the Eurocentric suprematism it probably is, we might add that Hegel is simply refusing the lure of authenticity and essentialism to suggest that meaning is always the effect of mediation. Historical consciousness is precisely the product of a lapse of time, in psychoanalytical terms of a gap, that creates a sense of desire with its constituting verso, loss or absence. In some ways, to grasp that there has been history, as opposed to merely sequential segments of lived time, there must be this intellectual reflection. Consciousness must be created of that which is no longer, or from that from which the reflecting subject now stands apart. In that sense, the museum is both an image of history and a historical image of the Hegelian European moment of historical subjectivity, in fact, of modernity subjectivity, that is predicated on the sense that it is new and therefore it is not of the past, it has lost something, the creation of the sort of the paradox of desire which we call modernity. Malherbe then offers a political reading of these poles of thinking, and this I hope will make you think that it wasn't so boring to go off into these 19th century thinkers. Quatre Mères de Quincy creates a dichotomy of theory versus praxis, of something abstracted from or living within culture. This thesis appears to stand for a cultural contextualization that many now in visual culture and cultural studies might absolutely applaud. The danger is that this can so easily become an apologia for fascist aesthetics, for nationalist and racist ideologies of relations between culture and land and blood and soil, which have kept artists out and people over there, as well as caused other more horrific events in the 20th century. Malœuvre says, the drive for identity stands behind all nationalisms. Now, Hegel's insistence that culture is always a theoria of culture, that's to say, always a mediated, reflective way of thinking about, analyzing, and understanding. That's what theory is trying to think about something, trying to analyze it, and trying to understand it. So culture is always a theoria of culture, or art is always a theory of culture, a way of understanding, analyzing, and thinking about what is different, what is non-identical. And this alone ensures a means of resistance. Malœuvre then argues, using Novalis' phrase of homeless conscience, that I quote, in offering an image of uprooted culture, the museum preserves the self-estranging drive of culture. In this sense, the museum stands true to antiquity by doing to antiquity what, as it were, culture did to itself. Thus, in comparing these two founding philosophical discourses on the 19th century on the museum and modernity, or the museum as one face of the modern, we can locate the contradictions that are indicative of modernity, itself dangerously tensed between a nostalgia for what is lost, which leads to us to desire tradition, connectivity, and self-identity, i.e. fascism, and on the other hand, its own inaugurating rootlessness and intellectuality between regressive, modernism and intellectuality, full stop. Modernism hangs between regressive conservatism and edgy estrangement as the drive of critical creativity itself. This is very similar to Julia Kristeva's work on the notion of the insistence of exile and dissidence as the very condition of any kind of non-administered thinking or thought. I want to return now to Malœuvre for one final moment before moving on to the question of posterity, the museum of and after modernism, and Judith Mastai's contribution to this complex field. The use of photographic reproduction after 1900 and the dissemination not just of a museum's contents, but of a museal concept of art through reproductive technologies as art books enabled the playing field to become less institutionalized and more subjectivized. For Malœuvre, the great historical shift is this. The terrain on which art now functions is that of the human mind, imagination, cognition, judgment. But in the mental museum, what is distilled is only that which can be held in common within this cacophony of diversity. Style annuls singularity. Instead of Hegelian difference, there is a classical humanist search for an internal identity between all objects, realized in what we call the dominant paradigm that MoMA itself imposed and Rudolf ironically held up for inspection in the person of the connoisseur. Style for Malœuvre bears witness simply to the human spirit of creativity. Krauss summarizes Malœuvre thus, I quote, these great fictions that the Musée Imaginaire makes visible are then so many stories about the collective spirit of human creativity, so many versions of the inventiveness evidenced by the family of man, like multiple documents of man's fate. In his introduction to Merleau-Ponty's critique and review of Les Voix du Silence, The Voices of Silence, Galen Johnson elaborates this problem further. Malœuvre's museum without walls, which of course I'm suggesting is the sort of absolute environment we live in through reproductive technologies of art history and the museum, Malœuvre's museum without walls was an intentional isolation in order to present a history of human artistic creativity. The panorama enabled Malœuvre to establish his central thesis about modern painting, but it is these that Merleau-Ponty critiqued. He wanted to critique the limitations of the modern-day art museum with its individualism and subjectivism, regarding modern painting as the expression of the painter's personal style or inner world, He also wanted to object to the objectivist Hegelian notion of a spirit of painting that controls the style of a historical epoch, even across cultures. And finally, most of all, no, wait a second, come back. Most of all, this is this little joke, hey Paul, don't sit on that chair, it's still wet. Most of all, he wanted to critique the cult of genius that goes with this regarding the heroes of modern art that approaches religious fervor. Influenced by Nietzsche and Gide, Malraux finds in modern painting a return to the worship of the sublime and exotic that characterized religion in its archaic modes. Following on the death of God, Malraux was determined to ward off death of culture and establish the artist as the replacement of the divine. Is this all too familiar? So the museum retrospectively flushes all art of the post-medieval era with the mourning colors of post-religious exile, but is then, however, disavowed by the substitution of the artist's genius and the cult of art distilled as style. Here, not only the aestheticization of art, but its sacralization reigns. Malraux writes, "What genius is not fascinated by the extremity of painting, by the appeal before which time itself vacillates? It is the moment of the possession of the world. Let painting go no further. Hence the elder has become God." In his analysis of Merleau-Ponty's phenomenological opposition to that kind of aesthetic, Galen Johnson picks out the philosopher's commentary on a film of Henri Matisse at work, and I've substituted Lee Krasner because she gets so little space in the museum, I thought I'd bring her in here. He's talking about a documentary in which Matisse is shown painting or drawing, and his pencil is arrested and moving above the paper before he makes his mark. In the documentary, Matisse expresses alarm when he sees this section of the film, i.e. the intervention of telescopy of the lens base. I was about to draw, and the size of my paper. Merleau-Ponty agrees with Matisse. The slow motion of the camera's eye should not be taken as revealing the truth about Matisse's gesture as a painter, for Matisse acted in the world of human perception, gesture, and time. But the film makes us believe the painter's hand originated in a physical world of abstract scientific possibilities. It is here that this question of the museum visitor with his binoculars can be situated, here being a complicated field of historical legacies, intertwining technologies of vision with institutional collection and isolation, display and presentation, and an effect that reifies the aesthetic simultaneously in the dual and possibly contradictory spaces of the utterly subjectivized interior world of an abstract spirituality or a rationally objectified flow of the spirit that form the basic pedagogical premises of museal art history, whether in the gallery of a book, and hence in the university or the art college. Now, Malraux's aesthetics are deeply indicative of that bourgeois moment. What we are learning about the history of museums reveals, in changing practices, what it shows us is the aestheticization of the work of art in the museum parallels the aestheticization, that is the neutralization and autonomization of the bourgeois subject in industrial society. The museum constitutes a formidable model of civic membership, a ritual of social identification, in short, a technology of the subject. This argument rehearses the core argument of Alan Wallach and Carol Duncan's founding analyses of the Museum of Modern Art as late capitalist ritual, which plotted out the process of a refashioning of subjectivity from the unsuspecting person who walked off the street through the doors and was taken through a labyrinthine ordeal, a choreographed encounter through ceremonial architecture, which revealed the deeply gendered structuring of an alienated bourgeois subjectivity. Now, by tracking this integration of the ideology of art's presentation in the museum and its virtual extension, the art book, the art history course, and the ideology of the autonomized bourgeois existence that we find in the movies, we can begin to imagine a counterforce, namely the possibility of a museum and a museum subject that is attuned to the emancipatory thrust of embodied, concrete, socially particular art-making itself. Perhaps it would do here to recall Merleau-Ponty's important distinction between peindre, to paint, the artist's living work, and la peinture, the painting, quote, the enshrined and abandoned artwork as fetish of capital exchange. Rather than being an institution dedicated to the education of its publics in conformity and compliance to canonical authority, Didier Malherbe argues that the museum still can become cultural in the Hegelian sense, suggested by the work of art that is liberated from what is fixed and too often essentialized as culture. I think this is a particularly important argument in terms of the points that Sunil Gupta was making earlier, where the Western European Museum can only allow culture from other communities or other, as it were, constituents, other minorities that it constitutes as other, to come when bearing the signs of their categorical difference. They are not allowed to be singular sites from which something of importance to everybody might be said. Even though clothed in particularity, it still has a capacity to address and should be heard because these are important things for everyone to hear. Instead, as Jean Fisher talks about this notion of culture, that the geopolitics of the new kind of cultural diversity too often denies the recognition that someone is speaking as opposed to somebody is advertising an imposed branding that alone, as it were, allows the passport into the Western Museum. So what fails, therefore, in museum education that aims at recontextualization is this difficult concept of art as the theoria of culture, the theorizing, the thinking of culture. Instead of the dominant tropes of consumption, commodification, and aestheticization, with their residual religiosity prevail, and even the introduction of visual culture or anthropological approaches to art as cultural practice find themselves in, as I've suggested, politically suspect company. Further, the danger that in the search for a means of reintroducing these cultural voices and places that Barr's canonical museum excluded, identity and related badges of cultural fixity become more than necessary momentary tactics, necessary and always dangerous, and trap some of us in permanent otherness rather than in the particularities of situated knowledges, located art making, with all its complex discomforts and disidentificatory potentials of what modernism has made of art. Now, I have tracked these somewhat arcane debates from the 1800s and the 1950s in order to create, I hope, a sufficiently complex framework in which to situate what I take to be Judith Mastai's practice as a cultural work on the side of the emancipatory thrust of art as living and an unashamedly intellectual practice. What I have gleaned more clearly than ever from reading through her surviving papers, drafts of which lie in my files from early exchanges and some of which were found on her computer, were three key points that for me defined the project. Firstly, Judith was deeply concerned with the question of the public art gallery, taking on the historical, hence modern, legacy of the museum, whose first post-revolutionary effect was to deprivatize collections of royal treasures and, let me just see if we're going to find that, and precious trophies to offer them to public ownership and view. Given both the Habermasian emancipatory definition of the public sphere and Foucault's depressing analysis of how, under the bourgeoisie, the public sphere would fall prey to the material mechanisms of economy and class power, this project to sustain or even reinvent the radical possibility of the instruments of public space and democratic communicative reason was no mean task. I think it was profoundly political. Secondly, Judith Mastai's work was unapologetically unapologetically intellectual. Indeed, the original document for the Summer Institute in Critical Museology that we planned at the AGO, of which this is, as in essence, a much belated event, was the legend, "An Invitation to Intellectual Play." What I did not understand then, am only realizing now as I do this work in the painful and terrible absence of her extraordinary mind and person, is the meaning of that phrase. For it was intellectual, cognitive, thinking, reflecting activity directed at understanding, at difference in the Hegelian sense, at transformation, not confirmation. It was cultural in the sense of play, something transformative, disruptive, not intending to align itself with officialized, authorized knowledges, canons of accepted interpretation or meaning. Play in its post-structuralist sense includes both the ludic, and hence the death drive, and the mechanical sense of give and shift that you have when you have a machine that's got a bit of play on it, even within inevitable restraints. What were we to play? Where were we to play but in the museum with the entire resources from collections to libraries to docents to registrars to packers and porters to guards to conservators and managers? The catalyst, the trickster figure in this anthropology of culture as knowledge-making and social change, was the educator. Not the servant of the curator or manager, but the figure of change. No longer the bearer or transmitter of formally disciplined information, the educator becomes a facilitator of a way of operating in the museum, once that is itself redefined as a public space with responsibilities not to some fetishized generality or fiction of the bourgeois mind called the public, but publics, specific, contesting constituencies with a variety of different competences, positions, needs, histories, and purposes, in relating to this arcane and perhaps even irrelevant resource, but which one could become a site of provocation of debate and of difference. I stress again this Hegelian notion of cultural work as disidentification rather than as a problematic medium for attempting to assimilate and hence reassert a selective, permissive hegemony. If cultural institutions are used to manage cultural diversity through an unchanged model of equations between cultures and identities, then the inherent racism, sexism, homophobia, and class structures are paradoxically confirmed. The challenge to the social relations of production, namely to racism, sexism, homophobia, has to be produced as an effect of working, as the creation of changed understandings at the level of the interaction of subjectivities with histories and geographies of difference that can be staged through the museum as a public institution. It is here that Judith Mastai's challenge to educational programming as the mere retailing and marketing of the essentially authoritative and in-house manufactured object-based narrative was most radical. For as I think I understand Judith's project, she wanted the very planning of exhibitions, the very structuring of the overall activities of the museum or gallery to be permeated by questions generated from the educational programming department, precisely because this department was the open passage that mediated between the conservatory and disciplinary operations of curators and the museum manager, and on the other hand, its publics, its constituencies, that the museum, the constituencies the museum and its works and workers have to serve rather than service. And finally, the third key point that I've deduced from my reflections on Judith's work and practice is the intimate but historically created relationship between the historically and theoretically informed critique of the origins and practices of the modern museum, modern in the sense of the revolutionary origins in the late 18th century, so relationship between the critique of the origins of the modern museum and the artistic practices that emerged in the late 20th century that are now rapidly being curated and museally classified, stroke killed, as conceptual art. Indeed, I would like to underline Judith's clear conviction that artists are particularly important thinkers to whom society needs to listen. Judith Mastai's interests in the work of Terry Atkinson and Mary Kelly, to name those who are present here, in the relations between art language, New York and Vancouver conceptualism, between feminist theory and interventions in practice, and various art histories, was not arbitrary. In her outline for a university course on the idea of a public art gallery, Judith Mastai specified the shift in the early 20th century to a deepening relation between the Museum of Modern Art and the art market, to the making of reputations, which put the idea of the public art gallery under severe scrutiny. From whom? It came under scrutiny from artists whose practice developed as institutional critique. The art gallery became the topic of work for many artists, many of whom were mentioned by Irit Rogoff in her talk. Daniel Buren, Hans Hacker, Martha Rosler, we can name many. From this evolved, she, argues Judith, much conceptual art. Thus, far from being merely another ism to be curated into the standard flowcharts of the like of which I showed you, Judith Mastai saw a kind of artistic practice, practice as critique itself, as part of the history of the museum and gallery, while at the same time that art strained the relations between making and curating, between market and authority. It tried to find a space in which art could work rather than fulfill the endless hunger of the commodity market with its value enhancers in the museum slash market slash studio circuits of NATO. Oh. Finally, Judith identified artists such as Anne Ramsden, Jamily Hassan, Irene Whittome, whose work addressed specifically the role of museums in positioning cultures and histories in relations to each other, with patterns of relativizing meaning that would nonetheless leave intact the core space of art again, once again for the world charted by NATO. Judith Mastai's practice thus defied the categories within which the art world is now strictly demarcated. Neither curator nor art historian, yet both. A public adult educator and performer in the art world, she rattled everyone's chains. She curated major exhibitions, one of enormous historical importance in the early work of Mary Kelly, resurrecting both The Night Cleaners, which I would claim is the most important political film since Coolavampa, and the collaborative projects of Margaret Harrison, Kay Hunt, and Mary Kelly, Women in Work. She edited a magazine. She initiated and ran a series of educational programs and events, especially at Vancouver Art Gallery and the Art Gallery of Ontario, that actively changed the terms of self-understanding, as well as the cultural placement of both the invited participants and of the local publics who formed the audiences and co-participants. At times, this was, as we've seen, quite violent, but nonetheless, it was important. Indeed, one of the most important indexes of Judith's commitment is the simple fact that she believed one of the museum gallery's major responsibilities was to the continuing education of artists in the community in which the gallery was situated. The concept of the public often excludes the primary constituency for an art museum, and artists and art students. If the gallery, the market, the magazine have been shown by artists in their critique of institutionalization of art to be nugatory, venal, incorporated, and complicit, Judith showed how else to use that public space for intellectual debate and the creation of a critical mirror in which we to read contemporary cultural arguments provoked by the making of art with serious and responsible intent. It is in this context, it seems to me, that Judith moved from the notion of a laboratory to the notion of performance, picking up on Antonin Artaud's definition of a performance as, I quote, a direct communication that can be established between spectator and spectacle, between actor and spectator, from the fact that the spectator, placed in the middle of the action, is engulfed and physically affected by it. In every way, she says, every day in many ways, my colleagues and I are engaged in performing a continually emerging institutional subjectivity. Change is not an interlude, but a condition of our work. Okay. So we are left not so much wondering about museums after modernism, but the purpose of this conference has to be discussed in some sense, what are we to do after Judith? I don't know, but we must carry on. And I thank you for your attendance, your presence, and I only hope that our deliberations and discussions offer some kind of monument and tribute, a remembrance rather than a memorial, to a most remarkable person whom we were privileged to work with and whom we must listen to even in her absence, but to continue. Thank you.